And that I know that that is within inside of me and within inside of you. And I'm always available for outreach calls. I do want to say this. I think that people are sometimes afraid to reach out to long-timers. Let me tell you, we need just as much support, I'm speaking for myself, as I ever did from the first day I walked in. All I have is today. So I'm hoping that if you resonate with anything that I have shared, that you will always be there to support me too, because I'm one bite away, and I never forget that, then I have a chance of living a life beyond my wildest dreams. Thank you for listening.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kimberly. I'm a compulsive overeater. Wow. What a great panel. Thank you all so much. And I was thinking, I love the metaphor of having a cosmic timer, and we will get a cosmic time up sign. We won't get the 10-minute and the 5-minute and the 1-minute warning, though. So it's I actually think that makes the metaphor even better, because it means that I really do need to pay attention to how I'm using my time, because I don't know when that will be. Thank you very much. I'm Kimberly. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm from White Plains, New York. Hi, everybody. And tell you a little bit about my story, and I do want to talk a little bit about service. I actually didn't really feel like this was a great topic for me. I didn't feel like I was worthy to talk about service. And somebody who shared a lot of the journey with me helped me point out that, you know, maybe I hadn't been the perfect Miss Service. I wasn't Miss OA, like in the skit last night. I hadn't been chairman of anything, but I have done a lot of service, so I was grateful to see that. I came into OA on May 14th of 1986. I lived in Paris, France, where I'd been living for a few years, and I was completely obsessed with my obesity. I would ride around in the subway and to and from work or to wherever one went on the metro, and I would always note fat and obese people. And it was easy to do because it was Paris, France. I like to say the land of the skinny-ass people. So I didn't know anything about other eating disorders then. But when I would see a fat or obese person, it was like it was a sad way of not being alone, and it didn't happen frequently. And in May of 1986, I have to say I was probably 27, 28 years old. I'm 53 now. And I had essentially been fat my whole life. I was a normal weight baby. And if you look over my mom's pictures of me for my whole life, there are a few pictures of me at different times where I was either just, you know, a little plump like any little kid or young kid, or close to normal weight, but I don't remember those times, and there are a ton of pictures of me when I was fat and then later getting to obese. I'm not really sure where the distinction is. Like, I didn't know there was a 25-year rule on old long-timers, but someplace in that place. I just remember being overweight my whole life, being the fattest kid in grade school, the fattest kid on the school bus at San Rafael Junior High, because I did live in Northern California for a while, and I hated riding the school bus because I took up more than half of a seat. And I don't know why that makes me emotional, because it's been a long time since I've had to share a school bus seat with anybody, but it was torture because another kid couldn't sit on the seat with me. I was one of the two or three fattest girls in college in Walla Walla, Washington. So I was a West Coast girl for a while, a woman. And then baddest person I saw many, many, many days in a city of millions of people in Paris, France. And so in May of 1986, when I came in, I was in a deep depression, and I went into an OA meeting in Paris, and there were three regular members in that meeting and three newcomers. And I got hope, and I started my journey of recovery. And I didn't believe I was a food addict. I didn't really believe in food addiction, but if you wanted to believe in it, it was okay. But I was definitely fat. And there were people in that meeting, those three women, and then other meetings. OA was a little bigger than that in Paris. There were other people who had been fat or obese and were no longer fat or obese. So even though I didn't believe I was a food addict, I didn't believe I was a sugar addict, I figured I would do what they said to do until I got thin, and then I was out of here. And quickly proved that my least favorite slogan was true, act as if. I didn't believe anything, but I did it anyway, and it worked. And years later, I realized what had happened. It became my favorite slogan. So in the beginning, I came to meetings. I didn't give a lot of service, but I was very socially uncomfortable with the whole meeting thing. So I would come in at a minute before or after the meeting started, and I would leave a minute or two after the meeting ended, unless somebody did service and kind of tackled me on the way out the door and made me talk to them. And then what happened was, you know, sometimes you screw that up and you get to the meeting a little bit early, and then if you're really socially uncomfortable, what do? Well, I put out chairs. Or I could put out the literature. And what happened was, I didn't know I was doing service. I was really trying to avoid talking to anybody. But it gave me something to do so I didn't have to panic if I was early at the meeting. And I didn't have to go stay in the restroom for 7 minutes. If there was a break in the meeting, I could check on the literature or whatever. And then I realized that after a while, people would come to the meeting and they were newer than me, and I wasn't socially shy talking to you if I had a role, so I would go talk to the newcomer and just say, hey, did you get we didn't have newcomers packets, but did you get the newcomer brochure, or, you know, what, there's another meeting on Wednesday night at this church or whatever. And what happened was, at my very earliest level, being of that kind of service, just putting out chairs, putting away chairs, talking to people who were probably scareder than I was, gave me a place in the room. And I never felt like I had a place anywhere. I mean, I don't really know if I was the fattest kid in grade school and the fattest kid in junior high, but I felt like I was. And I felt like, and today I do still feel like I'm not a good enough long timer, I'm not a good enough this, so I have this self-centered way of comparing everything to myself, and being of service at some level always helps me feel like at least I can fit in. I have a place and I have a role. And I realize that that's a little sick and I will keep coming back. But over the years I gave different levels of service. So I lived in France for my first year and change, and I lost my first couple years of program, I probably lost 60, 65 pounds. I'm maintaining a 50, 55 pound weight loss, which is part of my thing that I don't feel good enough. But in my first year or two of program, I realized that the equivalent of my first drink would be sugar at any time, eating in between meals, and then I had certain binge foods. I later, and I count my abstinent dates from the day I took wine out of my food plan. I had no clue that it was like drinking a cup of sugar. But, you know, we were in France, and my food sponsor had said, if you could handle wine at a meal, you can have wine at a meal. So I took wine, and sometime in the summer of 86, I was eating in between meals. I was struggling with craving wine like I used to crave chocolate, and I realized that wasn't good. So I, September or August of 86, I had my last glass of wine, and I had my last in between meals, and I don't know when that was, so just I count my abstinence from the first week of September of 86. And I so appreciated you saying that the food plan hadn't been perfect, because that was a nice thing for me. I've never picked up sugar. I've never eaten in between meals unless there was a medical or travel reason, and that I discussed it with my sponsor and planned it ahead of time, and that's maybe been, you know, three times, five times. I can't remember the last time that was. It doesn't happen often. And from Paris, I moved to the New York area in OA and lived there for a number of years, Westchester County, New York. Then from there, I moved up to New Hampshire, where I lived for 5 years and went to meetings, moved to suburbs of Philly, moved to Harrisburg, and I just moved back to White Plains. And in all those places, I did different kind of service. I was a literature person. I buy the literature. I'm always, if it involves shopping, I'm more than happy to volunteer. I was a treasurer sometimes at different meetings, and that was good. I would get the speakers, those kinds of things that, again, helped me feel a part, even though I did get much more comfortable. And then when I was in Westchester County, I volunteered one time to be the alternate intergroup rep. For some reason, it was really scary for me to volunteer, like for something that required a monthly commitment. So, but I could be the alternate. And then, wouldn't you know, the first intergroup meeting after I became the alternate, the regular rep couldn't go. And I thought, you know, that wasn't the plan. I was going to be the alternate and go when it was convenient for me. Later, I agreed to be the alternate regional rep, and the same thing happened. And when I was in, that was in a different region. I was had moved from Region 6 to Region 7, and I was really pissed. I had just a bad attitude about having to go to the regional convention. It was not convenient for me, and it was so inspiring. Oh, my gosh, I went because I had to give service, which just goes to prove acting as if, that, you know, it really plays. You don't even have to have a good attitude about giving service, and it still works. And there were all these people who had been in program and abstinent longer than me or had given a lot more service than I had or had different experiences, and it was like going to a convention. It wasn't like going and working all weekend. It was like going and just hearing great stuff all weekend. And it was so good for my program, and it was such a good lesson for me. And I did, in that intergroup, later become a solid, committed, you betcha I'll be there, Region 6 rep. And sometime in there, maybe even before that, so I was doing those things, and I think it was probably in 2007. I went to the World Service Business Convention. World Service Convention. I love World Service Conventions. And in whenever it was in Philadelphia, I think it was right about 2007. I had just moved from the suburbs of Philadelphia to Harrisburg to prove that God has a sense of humor. And I went to that convention, and I heard the then chairwoman of the board of Overeaters Anonymous give a speech that really rocked me. And it was about, I believe, the five practices of vital meetings. And one of them are a vital recovery, and one of these five practices was to give risk-taking levels of service. And I have to tell you, my biggest risk-taking level of service was that alternate thing and that alternate to regular thing. And I had really not given. I've gotten to be very comfortable talking in front of the crowd. So I'd done qualification. I'd shared in big meetings. I'd share at World Service conventions. When I had been to them, but really just committing to be the rep had been it, and I started thinking about it, and really what for me was the thing that I had always wanted to do, but was risky for me because I of my business career, was to go to the World Service Business Conference. And so that really got in my head. One, it meant I needed to give more service. It wasn't just do the big things, not that that's a big thing, that's an important thing, but so I tried to start giving more service, and as a regional rep, I had to I was one of the people that could be a World Service rep, so I volunteered to go to World Service, and it was risky because for me to know 6 months ahead of time that I can take a week off in my job, there's just no way to know. So that would have been, I guess, 2 years ago that I volunteered because I went last year. And in January, in my job, we have two or three things that at my level are command performances. You just do not miss them. And so January or December of last year, a year ago, I was in a business meeting, and they were rolling out the calendar for the year. And they're going through, you know, these are the meetings, and there is this. And this two-time-a-year meeting, that one of the do not miss under any circumstances was the same week as World Service Business Conference. And so I sat in that meeting and my heart sank. I had taken a risk and dang. And so I sat there and thought, my boss is going to kill me. I'm going. I committed. I'm going. And then I thought, and I should have thought, my region, my inner group is going to be disappointed. They wouldn't have killed me. But I have to tell you, part of my story is that I'm married to somebody in OA who was the intergroup chair and the other world service business rep, and I kept thinking, my husband's going to kill me. And then I thought, oh, I really want to go. Oh, my boss is going to kill me. And then this week at work is actually something where we get reviewed by my boss's boss's boss, right? So home office comes in to help. And my managers get reviewed, so it's really their review. It's my job to prep them, to throw myself on any land grenades if somebody makes a mistake. And I thought, oh, my people are going to be scared to death, and I'll let them down. But I really want to go, oh, my boss is going to kill me. Oh, my husband's going to kill me. Oh, I'm so, and, you know, so all day long, unfortunately, we did this like at 9 o'clock in the morning, and all day long I obsessed, and you all know that obsession. And then I, someplace in the middle, my program kicked in, and I said, okay, God, please show me what to do. Like, hello. Long timer, please show me what to do. Please increase my desire if it's your will. Please decrease my desire if it's your will. And after the meeting, I went up to my boss and I said, you know, you're going to kill me. But I made this commitment, and he knows nothing about my OA life. I've made this commitment to an organization that I'm a part of to go out to a board meeting, and I really would like to keep that commitment. And you know, I'm willing to not if you tell me, but I really would like to do this. I feel like that I have a commitment. They've already incurred some costs, but that was like the easy part because I could have reimbursed the cost if I had felt the need. And my boss was awesome. You know, he said, well, dang, I wish I could do it. Dang, you had such a good year. I just wanted you to show off the home office. And so I went, and I thought that was the risk. So I went to the World Service Business Conference, and it was awesome. And it was really, if you have the ability to do that, and you have to take some risks to go, I strongly encourage it. It was probably one of the really important moments for me in my recovery, gifts to my recovery. And then I came back from Albuquerque, and I got transferred. So I got transferred, and it was a great transfer from Harrisburg to White Plains, or to New York. Really good move for us. We were really glad to get back to the metropolitan area. But I really ended up with all of the life changes that I had. I probably fulfilled my commitment to my inner group as their World Service rep by doing the report backs and getting to some meetings and bringing it back, but I really didn't fulfill my commitment to the committee that I was on and to the World Service commitments that I took while I was there. And I have felt very ashamed about it, but for some reason as I was thinking about that, I thought, you know what, that's part of the risk she was telling me to take the risk in giving service, that I might not be perfect. Because for me, a recurrent theme in my life is I have to be perfect to be good enough. And what I believe in OA and in recovery and in life is that you don't have to be perfect to be good enough. You know, you have to be good enough to be good enough, not perfect. But so that was a good lesson for me there too. And I hope at some point I will have the opportunity to go back. I didn't volunteer this year in my new job, but I feel like I have a debt there that I can replay and repay. And an opportunity that I can go back and do better another time. And I hope that I remember that risk-taking means, part of risk-taking is being willing to be great and be loved and feel good, and part of risk-taking is doing things that I might screw up. You know, I tell my employees if they haven't made a mistake, they haven't taken enough risk. And maybe it, the same holds true in OA at a certain level. I don't want to do that with my food. So 1986, 20, coming 25 and a half years, And I believe, last year at the World Service Business Conference, I got asked to speak on a workshop, and I was so honored, and I got the topic, and it was the long-timers panel, and I said, what? Long-timers? How did that happen? And then I had to say, well, you know, 1986, it's been 24 and a half years, and I don't know how that happened, but somebody told me once that if you want to be a long-timer, don't eat and don't die. And I actually think that's almost it. I think it's don't eat, work the steps, and die, because I really think for me, the thing that has kept me coming, sometimes I've worked this program really, really hard, and sometimes this program I haven't worked it really hard. Sometimes I've been in recovery on gas fumes and sputtering down as the car, you know, just about stopped. And sometimes I've worked at the gas station and gotten gas every day, you know, love metaphors. So I'll be taking that one back east. But I did very much throw myself into OA in my first years and over the years. And I believe that the difference is working the steps to change my life or to let God change my life and giving as much service as that I can. And I want to close by something that I heard actually last week in my Sunday morning meeting. We were reading the big book, and we read in the third edition, it's Dr. Bob's story. They've changed it slightly, the name of it. And it was like a bells went off, because I said, oh, this is it. This is what I need for L.A. He said he continues to try and pass the message on for four reasons, and that one, he had a sense of duty to do it, and I feel very much I have a sense of duty. It's a pleasure, and it is. I love being connected here. I love being able to come to a birthday party in L.A. with, you know, a few hundred people, or I know maybe five of you. And I do feel like I have a big debt, like Dr. Bob, to the people who took the time to pass the message on to me. You know, those three women in that meeting, and then ultimately my sponsors in early OA spent a lot of time with me. And then his fourth thing I really love, and that is that every time I do try to pass it on, I take out a little bit of insurance against a possible slip. Somebody I know says that service isn't optional, it's the 12th step. And I think that that ties right back to that feeling of insurance. It's not optional, it is the 12th step, and it's the best shot I have at not eating. And I can't control the not dying part, but I think it is the difference in staying here. So thank you.
Over 100 years of abstinence. Kimberly, Sandy, Shelley, and Bill. Let's hear another round of applause. Wonderful, wonderful shares. So what we're going to do now is take questions from the Ask It Basket. And anyone who wants to step up and answer them, or there might be one... It might be some directed to a personal one of you. Okay, question. Give an example of fueling up or plugging into God. Give an example of fueling up or plugging into God.
I've actually had a good chance to work my program through giving service. And giving service helps to get plugged into God. For about 14 years, I lived in the San Fernando Valley, and I was on the what was called the Marathon and Retreat Committee for the intergroup for quite a while. And we planned a retreat at one point for people who were double winners, a phrase that I actually didn't know about until people on the committee were talking about it. People who were in more than one program, and I was only in one program, so I wasn't qualified to go, but I was on the committee, and so I went. And after that weekend was over, I realized that I needed another program, and I went out and went through a couple of them before I finally ended up in the sex program being 12-step there. So just being willing to give the service actually advanced my program enormously. It was a real turning point just to be on that committee and showing up and doing the work.
Okay, next question. What do you do with periods of time when you find yourself less willing to do the things that work? How do you adjust your program and get back to where you need to be? Would you like to?
A great phrase that I read early in the program and have heard is, on the gray days, follow the path of duty. And so there are days when I can get up and I can do more readings and I can spend a lot of time praying and I might even actually meditate. It's often a stretch. And then there are days when I'm on the way out the door and say, oh crap, I didn't do anything. And so I keep that in mind. Follow the path of duty. And for me, the path of duty is sticking to my food plan, not taking the first compulsive bite. Not taking the equivalent of my first drink, my first addictive bite. I'm in insurance, which is why I like that, but I'm not in medicine. I like the first do no harm, and I try and remember that. So if I can't do anything else, I can pray, God, please help me. I could say, please help me stay abstinent. I can maybe read one of the meditation pages for the day rather than the several that I usually read, and try to say thank you at night. And so that's a great phrase, just on the gray days, follow the path of duty, because if you're around long enough, people are going to die and people are going to lose jobs and life gets really, really hard, and moods are up and down and up and down and bright and gray and bright and gray. So just follow the path of duty and have a mantra to help. Thanks.
Okay. How do you balance self-care with giving service? I'd like to answer that. How do you balance self-care with giving service?
Where's the question again? How do you balance
balance? Sometimes I lean this way, sometimes I lean this way. I got to find that center part. For me, forgiving balance is, if I don't take care of myself first, I cannot give service. If I don't eat the way I'm supposed to, because I have to eat 3 meals a day, 2 snacks, sometimes I'm supposed to have 3, and go to my meetings and do what I need to do, that's what keeps me in balance so that I can give service and be able to give it without any hesitation. If I don't follow those little restrictions I put on myself, then my head goes crazy, my mind starts wandering, voices in my head, and how could I sit in a meeting and give service or talk to someone and give service when I'm not really there? So I just follow the program, do what I'm supposed to do, so I can go in there with a clear head, clear heart, and do what I'm be open to anybody or anything that needs to be done. Thank you.
All right. Which tool do you utilize most when you feel you are at the end of a very frayed rope? Maybe frayed? Would that be an F? Okay. So which tool do you utilize most when you feel you are at the end of a very frayed rope? At the end of your rope.
Which tool do you utilize most when you feel you are at the end of a very frayed rope? Well, you know, here's the thing. sometimes I get at the very, very, very end of a very frayed rope. And then at that point, you know, I think what I do, it's not an official tool, is I pray. But what I've learned is that I don't have to wait until I get to that point. And that's part of the sanity that we get restored to as we continue to work these steps. That I don't, again, I said earlier, I don't have to suffer. That's a choice. To me, this sounds like suffering. And I have developed self-love through this program. So I think the tools that I use the most are really the steps. I think those are really what I use the most. So I'm going to say that for me, that when I am praying, when I'm meditating, when I'm writing, when I am sponsoring, when I'm talking to my sponsor, it's a combination. I couldn't tell you which one works, so I just try to tap them all. I don't know which one to eliminate. It's a prescription. So that's the best way I know how to ask that. But I don't want to suffer. I don't have to fray.
Okay, can you talk about help with impatience? I only weigh in monthly. Today is day 84. I find myself sad, angry, and discouraged with how slowly the weight is coming off. 11 pounds in 60 days. Can you talk about help with impatience?
Oh, God, impatience. I have been on this road to try to lose another 10 to 15 pounds. And I've been on this road for quite a while. And I was getting very impatient and getting very frustrated and not enjoying the way I looked or how I felt. And I heard somebody say in the program that this program is not about weight. This program is about liking yourself. And that I remember when my sponsor had me stand in front of the mirror with no clothes on and give myself a hug to tell myself how much I loved myself the way I was. That working the program in God's time, that's when the weight would come up, not in my time. To this day, I have my sponsees do the same thing, stand in front of the mirror, put their arms around themselves, look at themselves, and say, you know what? I'm happy with my body. I'm happy with where I'm at. For now. Remember, this is a program of a day at a time, a step at a time, minute at a time. It's not because you want this weight to come off now. And being diabetic, my weight comes off very, very slow because of my insulin. And you know what? I've learned to just, you know what? Here I am. This is where I'm at. And you know what? I like where I'm at. I love my body, even though I have a pooch that hangs out. You know what? That's life. That's where God wanted me to be. So remember, this program is not just about losing weight. It's not about the numbers. I hardly get on the scale. It's not about the numbers. It's about what you want from this program. If you're here for a diet, then you really got to think about that. But this program is to help us heal ourselves from here to our toes. And patience, you know what? If you're doing what you're supposed to do in the program and just sitting back and letting God run your life, that's patience. And if you don't have that, make outreach calls. Write. Do a gratitude list of how thankful you are for what you've got. I always tell God, I'm thankful for my eyesight, for my job, for the relationship, for my house, for all these other things. And that I'm healthy. I am very healthy. Those are also things to look at to make you feel better. Thank you. Okay, some great questions. Okay, next. What do I do when I can't regain my long-term abstinence? What do I do when I can't regain my long-term abstinence?
I'm working with a sponsee who slipped and needs to come back, and it's a process. The process is examining how did the patterns change, what are the new patterns, what can we do to change the plan of action on a daily basis so that we start seeing results. And it involves a certain amount of analysis. It involves a lot of talking. I would have daily conversations with the sponsee about what went on the previous day. It's going back to the basics, getting back on track. The sponsee has a really wonderful spiritual program and works very hard at it. And in fact, I admire his spiritual program because I don't think that I have nearly as good a one as he does, to be honest. But there were things that were getting in his way, and one of them was fears. And one of the things I've learned in writing inventory is that fears are symptoms of our character defects, as are our resentments. Resentments, fears, sexual conduct. Those are the three areas the Big Book talks about in terms of doing inventory. And they're all indications of our character defects. If we do the same thing over again, or if we have the same feelings over and over again, then we get to, then there's a character defect involved there somewhere. So we sat down over time and we were looking at places where he was fearful and what did that reflect. And bit by bit we worked through some of that. And I'm happy to report that he's doing quite well now. But it was a long time, and he came into meetings and announced that he was no longer abstinent and he wouldn't take sponsees for a while. And now he's doing a lot more reaching out. He's actually saying yes to sponsoring again. And I don't know if we're completely through it, but we're mostly through it. And we've been looking at just small changes that he can make. It doesn't have to be like throw his whole program out and start over again. It's let's build on what you've already done, and let's build on the strengths that you already have, and just examine what are the changes that we can make in the program that will get you abstinent and keep you abstinent on a long-term basis. And it's been a couple of years, to be honest, in terms of doing that. So it's taken a fair amount of patience, but it can be done.
All right, thank you. All right, does the food still call you? If so, what do you do? Does the food still call you? If so, what do you do?
It's my turn, I was told. Sometimes more calls me. My binge foods don't call me too much. I've really cultivated over the years, and I encourage you to do this, cultivate looking at binge foods as a poison. So that I don't look at a binge food and say, oh, that looks so good, oh, that would taste good. I might do that, but I try to immediately say, oh yeah, then I would eat another one, and then I would wait until everybody went on break, and I would grab two, and then I would go buy some on the way home, and then, you know, next week I wouldn't have clothes to wear, and I couldn't come to work. So I try to think the bite through. So that's a very good thing to do. I also try to remind myself that I really
maybe I was always a food addict, maybe I wasn't, but I've just abused the privilege. And I tell people, normies, this all the time, oh, you can't eat that? And I, first of all, I don't say, I try not to say I can't eat it. I say I don't eat it. And you can't eat it? And I was like, trust me, if you and I both die at 90, we will have eaten the same amount of chocolate. I just got mine in early. So, and it's a great line when you're in public, but I really try to believe that. Like, we get a quota of snack food, and I ate my quota, and I ate some of your quota. So, and if I can remember that, I don't feel sorry for myself. This concept of wanting more is a very real thing for me. And the book tells me that if, and I believe this is the OA 12 and 12, but I think it's parallel with our AA books, that if I occasionally have a compulsion to eat more, I will find relief in the steps. So I try to remember that the answer is always in the steps and in the program and in doing more. I always want it to be less, like, I want more food, so I won't go to the meeting tonight. That's not good. So try to do more and try to stay focused on the steps. And I believe what I would benefit from is just an ongoing, regularly consistent 10th step so I catch those character defects in action before I start feeling them in cravings. Thanks.
All right. How has your spirituality grown over the many, many years? How has your spirituality grown over the many, many years?
Okay. So this is an interesting word for me, spirituality. I don't believe there's any such thing as a spiritual person. I just believe we're human beings and there's an experience that's possible to have. The big book talks about being catapulted into the fourth dimension. I don't live in the fourth dimension all the time by any stretch, but I have had those glimpses. And, here's what I know is that I have to keep it really, really simple. I have to keep it so simple for myself because the question before, again, it was my metaphor about the divine gas station, what that looks like for me is if I picture a car and my car is out of gas or going to be soon and I pull up to a gas station, there's a pause, and I need to take the gas pump and I need to connect it to my gas tank and fuel. And so for myself, and this has been just progressive, as regular as I can be, continually practicing all these years, is a pause. I can call it meditation, where I am willing to sit and receive, where I am willing to sit and even be with my thoughts that may not feel pleasant, but that if I sit with an open mind and open heart, and I have techniques that I have been taught that I use to go within, that what begins to happen is that my mind becomes quieter and I am aware of a presence and a feeling that I'm not aware of if I don't do that. The more I do that, the more aware I am of that feeling when I'm not deliberately pausing and receiving it. So what's grown for me is I see that that is where my joy comes from, that's where my happiness comes from, that's where my peace, that's where my sanity comes from. And if I don't do it, then I do suffer. And my tolerance for suffering is getting shorter and shorter and shorter because I just have visited an alternative. So I know that this will be something that will be necessary the rest of my life. But I'm very, very grateful to have the tools and to know the way inside of myself.
All right. Question. As I'm As I am approaching goal weight, I am finding it difficult to transition mentally from weight loser to weight maintainer. How do you make that shift? How do you do maintenance different from the weight losing phase? Finding it difficult to transition mentally from weight loser to weight maintainer. How do you make that shift? Anyone?
My answer is, the program's the program. I follow the same program. I don't change. The program is set up for me. I follow it as I'm losing weight, and I keep following the same thing. I eat the same foods. I don't change. I stay exactly where I... Okay. It's like going in the gas station and using the same kind of gas every single time.
Sorry, Shelley, I had to use your gas station.
You know, it doesn't change. I went from where I was, and in my food ever since I've been a diabetic, I haven't changed it, and I've lost weight. I'm staying at the same weight, and I have not changed my food. You know, my portions may change a little. You know, that's the only thing that may change is my portions from what I was eating when I was losing to what I'm eating now. You know, I really measure out my food and make sure that I'm eating what I'm supposed to eat. But I still work the same program. I still have the sponsor. I still do the steps, the tools, outreach calls. I call in my food every day. That's what I do.
I think we have time for one more before we wrap it up. Breaking abstinence. What exactly does that look like for each of you? Breaking abstinence. What exactly does that look like? If they'd like to hear briefly.
Okay, for me, I abstain from certain foods, so if I were to eat those foods, I would break my abstinence.
How about ditto? I'm on a food plan where I don't eat any sugar. I haven't had sugar for 25 years. I don't eat any white flour. I really don't eat any starchy carbs. I really keep mine kind of strict because of my diabetes. But my main thing is no sugar, no white flour at all. And you know what? That is my abstinence, and I do not touch anything that has either one of those in it.
You know, I have a defined abstinence. I defined it by becoming aware of what my addictive substances were. I put it on a piece of paper, and I put what it is inside this circle. 3 meals a day, no sugar, no flour, no marijuana, no alcohol, up to 2 snacks, and I make an effort to define what a snack is. That's in the circle. So if I'm eating a fourth meal, or if I'm eating something and I'm outside the circle, I've broken. I've not slipped through the wall. I have broken right through it. I guess I don't believe in slips. And that comes from just clearly defining what it is and what it isn't from an honest place within myself.
I believe we have to define what our first addictive bite is, because in AA they say away from, I hear, one drink for one day, and we have to nourish ourselves, and that's the supposedly, theoretically, the point of eating. So we have to know what's the difference between the theory and picking up the alcohol. So for me, I've identified with my sponsor the equivalent of my first alcoholic bite, my first drink. And a great tool that I discovered later in program is a three-column list. Write down my A foods, those are my alcoholic foods and eating behaviors. My C column is my clean foods and my clean eating behaviors. And my B are my, what I called in the beginning, my gray foods, in which some of them were really things that belonged on my A list that I was trying to rationalize. Like for me in the beginning when I was drinking wine, I might have had it as a B food, but it really was an A substance. And then some of them are things that I don't crave, but I have to weigh and measure them. I can't ballpark the thing. So if I have that A list, my alcoholic foods and eating behaviors, then I just have to stay away from that for a day, and it defines my abstinence. And it helps me live by that just for today's philosophy.
I'm sorry, I forgot to say one thing. If anybody else is a diabetic in here, I have to tell you an experience, because my abstinence has been broken, but not because of eating. I was walking in a shopping mall and my blood sugar dropped. And I mean really low, where I was about to pass out. And this is when I first became a diabetic. And there was a candy store right there. And they tell you, grab sugar right away. And I said, no, no, I'll lose my abstinence. I got to a point where I was literally going on the ground. And there was Mrs. Fields cookies. And my partner had to stuff a cookie down my throat to eat so that I wouldn't pass out. To me, that is not losing my abstinence. That's staying alive. And I've had many instances, but now I carry raisins and I carry glucose pills. I carry things that are healthy for me. But if you have a disease or a health problem where you need to grab something as soon as you need to grab it, that is not losing your abstinence. And I wanted to clarify that, because I think it's very important that people know. I really thought I lost my abstinence. I was so depressed and I thought, oh my God, I haven't had sugar, and you know what? I didn't lose my abstinence. It was a medical problem. So thank you.
I'd like to thank all of our panelists here. This is all the time that we have. Just to remind you that no one here is a spokesperson for OA. Everyone here spoke only for themselves. I'd like to thank you all for joining us today. Please join me in thanking our panel members one more time for sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And I wish you a great weekend of abstinence and recovery. Let us all stand now and join hands and say the Serenity Prayer.